This is the final World Cup Sound of Football.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the World Cup Sound of Football, the last edition of the World Cup Sound of Football, as it turns out. Chris Oakley here, as ever. Welcome aboard. Yes, it's as we speak, it's about 3 days after the World Cup final took place. I think dust has settled, and it's time to take stock of what we've seen. So, Terry and Graham, welcome. Terry DeFellin and Graham Sibley, of course, if you hadn't already worked that one out. And if you've only just joined us after 49 podcasts, then frankly, where the hell have you been? But Terry, Graham, hello there. So let me take you back. 11th of June, first day of the World Cup. 4 years in the making, of course, if not longer. All this hoo-ha about South Africa hosting the World Cup, and lots of people, frankly, doubting whether it was a good place to have a World Cup anyway. And, of course, we started off, had the opening ceremony, dung beetles et al. To feast your eyes on. And then the first game, South Africa against Mexico. A great game to start off, of course. 2-2, I think it was in the end. Sifiwe Shabalala's goal, how's that for pronunciation? And basically all round, looked like some optimism there for the home country to begin with, wasn't it, Terry? It was a good start to the competition.
Yeah, it was. It was a cracking goal. Was it 2-2?
It was 1-1.
Was it 2-2? Sorry, 1-1.
Yeah. Yeah. 2-2 was there, wasn't it?
Good save. which was, of course, what I meant.
Of course, yes, sorry. Yeah, no, it was a cracking game, a cracking goal, and lots of early optimism for Bafana. And we were all worried that they would be a bit of a letdown as hosts this season, this World Cup. And, well, as it turns out, that they were. But, you know, for that one moment, we thought, here we go. You know, South Africa are going to really do something, and it's going to be a fantastic World Cup, and they're going to be at the heart of it. And of course Mexico, who also gave us a great deal of entertainment for while they were in the World Cup as well, and a good start to the campaign, albeit sort of perhaps a bit misleading, because the first round of fixtures were, shall we say, took a little bit of time for the players.
There was hardly any goals, was there, for the first round, was there? And it certainly picked up afterwards. But
You looked at more than ever. It was so pronounced, I think, the way that the teams just decided, let's just see if we can get a point under our belt in the first game, and then we'll build on that. I mean, you see, for a lot of teams in previous World Cups doing the same thing, but it seemed like almost everybody was doing it. It was just incredible, wasn't it? Really, it was just sort of lots of draws and not too many goals going in. So that was the first day of the World Cup. Let me just take you back. I'm going to throw a few of these in during the course of the podcast. You may remember we did a World Cup preview just a few days before the World Cup started, and we did rashly make a few predictions. And if I could draw your attention to those that we made. These aren't all bad, by the way, because we were surprisingly lucid at times. We did actually get things spot on, but not always. As regards Group A, when we were talking about Group A, I seem to remember saying France looking a little shaky at the moment. Little did I know that was a bit of an understatement. And I also went on to say Uruguay, I don't think there's much spark there. Of course, they ended up getting into the semi-finals, so that was a kind of a nice sort of high watermark to set there. But anyway, the following day, the 12th of June, I'm not going to be going through every single day of this World Cup, by the way, but 12th of June, England's first game. They drew 1-1, as you remember, with the USA. And, of course, the Robert Green howler, which went down in the annals of football catastrophes of a goalkeeping nature. Surprisingly, Graham, really, I mean, in retrospect, looking back on England's campaign, England didn't seem to play too bad in that first game. It was only sort of second game on was really the rot set in. But against the USA, they got an early goal, looked very sort of positive and looked like we were all going to sort of settle down for a nice kind of easy World Cup from an England perspective.
Yeah.
Of course, conceded one late on. And everyone sort of thought, well, you know, we're playing the USA, good team, so a draw, maybe not such a catastrophe. And it was all still looking quite sort of okay, really, wasn't it, at that point?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I think everyone was a bit disappointed by it because we did go in with really high expectations and even up. But I think the thing was that although we were disappointed after the USA game, we had no idea what was to come.
Indeed.
And I think that was the real annoyance of the whole thing was just how bad it was going to get. It was weird actually, because like when at the end of the World Cup when they were doing all their montages, and then all of a sudden you see like England clips in there. Oh yeah, England were in this World Cup, weren't they? Because you know, we'll come on to this later, but you know, the tournament just got so much better after England went out.
You mean just from an England supporter's perspective, like there was no pressure anymore, or just generally the World Cup was better off without England in some way?
Well, you know, we can only go on the way that it's reported over here, and you know, once you switch yourself off from the sort of like you know the column inch filling recriminations, I mean, you don't bother reading that or listening to it or turning off from that on Sky Sports News. Then you know you get you can just like bask in what else is going on. I mean, like you know, the four quarterfinals. I mean, like, it was probably one of the best quarterfinal rounds I think I can ever remember. Not because of the quality of football, but just because of the fact that every game had some weird and wacky incident in it that made it stand out.
Oh yes, more of which later actually. But So England starting off with a draw, and then we had our first Sound of Football podcast the following day, Germany beating Australia, and there we got our first sight of a tremendously efficient Germany team walking all over Australia. Frankly, I'm sorry to say, but Australia had the man sent off, as we know. Was it? I'm not sure if it was Harry Kewell in that first game.
It was Cahill in the first one, wasn't it? And then
Cahill
in the second.
One, that's right. Yes.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, indeed. And so, well, and then a few days later. France easily beaten 3-0 by Mexico, and that was really when the alarm bell started ringing, Terry, for the French team. I mean, let's take a moment to just sort of pause and reflect on France, because what did you make of that whole episode, really? Because I mean, obviously everyone was just staggered at how you can just not bother playing for the pride of your country. Or is there, what I mean, what did you make of it?
I thought it was, well, surreal at times and almost art house. my favourite moment, and I think I'm not alone in this, was Domenech outside the team bus sort of reading that statement read by the players, and it was just, it just transcended itself into some kind of, you know, avant-garde cinema piece. It was beautiful and really surreal. I have no idea why players are unable to motivate themselves to play for their country in the way that it seems that France couldn't do. It can only be a reflection on just how poorly managed the arrangement there must be, that they're not even prepared to go out there for their own professional pride or perhaps for any feelings of patriotism that they may have. Maybe they're just not a bunch of patriotic people. Maybe, I mean, the criticism is that they are the very model of footballers' excess, the very thing that we often find ourselves complaining about modern footballers when we're in the pub. That they took that to absolute success, and they had become so obsessed with themselves that they didn't realise until it was far too late that they had actually become actually quite rubbish. They had a shit manager, and they played really, really bad. And deserved absolutely everything that they've got, but still and all could have, just by their own strength of will, if they chose to, got themselves possibly even through to the quarterfinals of the World Cup, just if they bothered to organise themselves and ignored their coach.
I think it's because it's easy in this World Cup to sort of like draw parallel to sort of lump Italy and France in the same sort of boat. We're just saying, look at these two teams. Like, everyone thinks they're great and they're actually rubbish. I mean, Italy at least tried to turn up, but they just weren't good enough, and they were in a group that actually proved a lot tougher than everyone thought it was going to be, and didn't seem to have the fight for it. France, however, they were just you know, I think shambolic is like the perfect description for it, really.
I just found staggering is, okay, fine, so you've got a manager that you don't like. You're stuck with him. Somebody has made the decision to kind of keep him on for the 2010 World Cup. Okay, you know, if you've got issues with him, speak to him. I mean, you know, even John Terry managed to have a quiet word with his coach when he had a few problems. But I mean, yeah, and it, but it just they just decided, no, we're going to make our statement on the training field and to some extent on the actual pitch for the proper game. I just thought, why can't you have just sorted that out? At least play for the pride of your country. I mean, don't you realise there are people back home that are just basically just thinking of you as merde, frankly? It's just, it was staggering. I just can't believe that you could be so stupid.
Yes, well, but I mean... I think it's slightly deeper than that, isn't it? Because obviously there was the whole Nicholas Anelka thing that sparked off said statement and boycotting training. So it was more than Dominic. In fairness, it was the city. It was the whole sort of like it was the coaching setup, and it was the coach who grassed up Anelka to the French Federation, who then demanded that action be then taken, and it all sort of falling apart from there. So it was obviously systematic within the French. National team set up that they had alienated their players to the extent that their players just didn't want to play for him anymore and were so obsessed with themselves that I don't think they actually realised what was actually going on around them. Interesting what Graham was talking about with Italy, and I said this in one of our podcasts when we were talking about England, was that Italy's problems are simply down to team selection. Lippi got it wrong, badly wrong. England's problems, we reckon, we may talk about this later, I don't know, but England's problems were systematic, or are systematic. We don't produce good international footballers. France's problems are to do with the institution of the French national team. Their whole system is completely balked. They have got the players, and they keep producing the players, but their national team needs basically to have to be completely cleared out and replaced with people who can command the respect of the players and can galvanise their players and re-engage their players. So there's three different types of problems going on there for those three sort of like big nations, if you like, that fall in the way.
What I've read about, following on my interest last season in French football, from what I've read in some of the French press, it just sounds like they're now in the process of having a complete root and branch replacement of pretty much everyone in the training staff. And obviously Laurent Blanc is now coming in as the new coach. And I think only one person from the old training group, shall we say, all the assistants and the coaching staff, and only one person remains, Alain Bogossian, I think he was, who's Domenech's right-hand man. I think he's the only person to survive out of this and to still have a position. So that shows you how seriously they're taking that. And as you say, of course, then it's all a question of bringing some new players who've got a bit more hunger. So there we go. So yes, the whole French affair.
Of course,
very, strange.
Of course, the other thing from the first round of fixtures was the score right in one of the last games of the round of fixtures where Switzerland beat Spain.
Yes,
and how telling was that going to be in the weeks to come? And
well, it was strange. I mean, obviously, Switzerland became sort of the only team to beat Spain in the whole of the World Cup, and indeed, only one of about three teams to beat Spain in about the last 3 years, and. It's strange, obviously, now again, in hindsight, with now that the final is out of the way, that a lot of people were saying about Holland's approach to sort of nullifying Spain in the final. Some people were sort of saying, why not? You know, they could have just taken the approach that Switzerland did in the first game and just play a very organised defensive game. Maybe it's a bit sort of previous to be sort of talking about the final at this stage, and we're just maybe sort of still dwelling on the early stage. But how do you both sort of subscribe to that? I mean, presumably they could have done that, couldn't they, the Dutch? Or is it just completely not in their sort of realm of tactical, how to approach a game tactically?
I don't think that they could have done that because I don't think that the way the Swiss plays is very well drilled. They would have practiced that an awful lot. And the Dutch are more, although a lot of people wouldn't have said this by the strength of the World Cup, they are a more proactive, more attacking team. They're not, and the Swiss, in fairness, were set up to play that way. And I don't think it's necessarily a system that the Dutch
I agree with that. I think the Dutch are good at playing teams they're better than. Which sounds really stupid, but you know what I mean.
Exactly what you mean.
They can play well and play an expansive style of football if they're playing a team they're actually better than. But going up against Spain, they know that if they tried to play their own game, they would have been beaten. And as it was, they tried to play another game and they were beaten as well. So yeah, I mean, honours even at the end for in the final. But I'm sure we'll discuss that later.
Yes. So, all that taken into consideration, then England drew 0-0 against Algeria, which I think we're all in agreement was probably the worst England performance since Stanley Matthews was about six. It really was just an awful, awful, uninspiring performance. And then just to top it off, you had Wayne Rooney then trudging off the field and expressing his delight at the fans' support, which just topped it off for me. I just thought, dear me, we've reached an all-time low, I think. And then you had the John Terry press conference. So let's just stop for a moment and talk about England then in that case. I mean, It's kind of difficult to know where to start, but I heard an interesting thing on the radio the other day. Howard Wilkinson, of all people, were talking about the sort of master plan that he put in place when the FA were interested in his experience and his expertise and all the rest of it that he's had down the years, and they asked him to draw up this kind of master plan of how the English game should be improved. He sort of put down lots of stuff like, I don't know, the fact that England should ditch the 4-4-2, which was quite far-sighted of him, and adopt something else, like a 4-3-3 or whatever, and all the way down to things like, you know, kids shouldn't be playing team football at such an early stage, blah, 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 and also to have a national football centre. And seemingly, obviously, the FA just sort of ditched that, had a quick look at it, and then threw it in the bin, and we now find ourselves in the state we're in now. So, I mean, is it literally is it easy just to sort of say, wow, if the FA had carried out that plan, that we'd all be in a better position now? Or, I mean, it's such a wide-ranging kind of, well, I wouldn't say crisis, but, you know, bad position to be in, isn't it, really?
Terry, go ahead.
So much so, said.
The National Footballing Centre is in Burton. Well, we'll be in Burton. I mean, I think that the problem with that is because Wembley overspend, and so Burton hasn't happened yet. A lot of what Howard Wilkinson was talking about is the same thing that Trevor Brooking continues to talk about, and he's the current FA technical director, and is some of his reforms have come through, which we're beginning to see in earlier younger England teams. The idea of sort of homogenising the coaching methods is hampered by the fact that we have the sort of county and regional FA structures that use different methods, and also because of the culture that we have in English football, which people complain about an awful lot. The sort of, you know, dads yelling from the touchline, and they're uber competitive, and, you know, and there's too much emphasis on strength and power and pace and blah, blah, blah. And all of this I completely agree with. And I think that, you know, there is much that we can do at a root level, at a grassroots level, at a youth level, to be able to prepare England players to be able to play international football, not only in England, but also in Europe, in other countries in Europe. But it doesn't actually excuse the existing crop of players for not being able to pass the ball to each other.
Mm.
You know, they are not that bad, you know, that they can't pass the ball to each other. I can imagine you can probably blame the formation. You could probably perhaps, you know, just simply blame the players for just not either being fit enough or conditioned enough. You could blame the coach to an extent. You could blame the Premier League. But whatever the factors are, and there are no doubt many, when it comes down to it, the resultant England team cannot pass the ball to each other, and most of the time can't shoot straight. And that is something that can actually be rectified in the short term. In the longer term, yes, let's all play, you know, 4-3-3, and let's all, you know, create our own army of Mesut Ozils and Sami Khedira's who can go out and win the tournament. But those players won't be playing in the Premier League, by the way, because they will get eaten up. It was, sorry to blow on, but one rare moment of insight from Lee Dixon was, he said, if you look at Thomas Müller of Germany, he's 6 foot something. Had he been English, he'd have been 2 stone heavier. Mm-hmm. Maybe half a yard quicker, but we wouldn't have been able to attract a bag of soot with his foot. You know, he would not be the player that he is if he'd been an Englishman and played in the Premier League. And we do need to address things like that. But ultimately, we can't let the existing crop of players get away with it. We can't pat them on the head and say, oh dear, you're just not good enough, are you? Because they should be good enough. They should be good enough. If they can get to the latter stage of the Champions League, they should be able to play football. It may not be good enough to win the World Cup. They're certainly good enough to get to a later stage than that. Anyway, that's my rant done. Graham, your turn.
Well, I think I echo quite a lot of that, really. I mean, I knew the Algeria match was going to be pretty much the worst game ever after about 5 seconds when Frank Lampard failed to pass to get over 4 yards.
And yes,
it was just unbelievable, and it just went downhill from there. And there is no, you can't really overemphasize how bad that game was, and we should have lost it. We really should have done it. It would have been better if we'd lost that game, because it would have really shown England up for you know what they were. The fact that we went on to beat Slovenia in the last game. No one was really that convinced, were they, when we came out of that group?
No, indeed. It was sort of slightly better, but still not, you know, way short of the standards that perhaps we'd be expecting. And obviously the few people, you know, Algerians themselves sort of saying that, they felt they sort of played better than England. I'm not so sure that's the case. Anti-Algerian. I just generally don't think they played, you know, under normal circumstances. I think England would have won that game. There we are. There's so many things there just to go on. There's read so much material in the papers and whatever during the World Cup, things like statistics about how many qualified coaches there are in Spain per capita compared to in England, and so much stuff. It does kind of get you down, but there was a very sort of far-sighted piece in The Guardian, I think it was by Richard Williams, who essentially said if England bomb out earlier this World Cup, then there could be huge repercussions on things, like, for instance, England's first friendly that they've got coming up next, which will be against Hungary at Wembley. You can expect the stadium to be only, what, a third full, because nobody will be interested and they've gone off the national team. That means there is enough money rolling into the FA, so therefore they won't have enough money to, say, keep relaying the pitches, so therefore they're going to have more events at Wembley to get the money, and it just goes on and on, and it was actually a very, very well-written piece, and it's quite depressing, really, if all of that kind of actually comes to fruition. We could end up in a situation like, ironically, Hungary, perhaps, albeit in a different era from back in the 50s and so on and so forth. It just could be a downward spiral from here on in. But anyway, let's pick the mood up a little bit now, shall we, by changing the subject. Needless to say, we thought that England would top the group and beat everybody in sight, so that was one prediction we said on our preview, which we can probably easily gloss over. So Italy, not long after that, were dumped out of the competition by Slovakia. We mentioned Italy before. What did we say about Italy? We said, I think, Graham, you said, I think Italy will draw 0-0 with New Zealand. And when I said, but Italy, New Zealand, Italy beat New Zealand 4-3 in a recent year, you said, oh, no, that was just a warm-up. And as it turned out, actually, you know, I think I may have had some insight there when I sort of proffered that as a possibility.
That was a win. I did pretty much dance around to say that I did pick a draw there in that game.
You said that Group F would be the group of craziness, and I think you got that absolutely spot on. To your credit, you absolutely got that nailed there, I think. And there was me sort of saying, well, there's two positions in that group that I think are nailed on. That's the top and the bottom, Italy and New Zealand. Yes, shut up, Oakley. What are you talking about? Italy, as we've mentioned before, Italy just went out by virtue of the fact that they had a squad which were far from convincing in the Confederations Cup. I think you mentioned this in a previous one, previous podcast, Terry, the fact that they weren't convincing in the Confederations Cup last year. So what happened? The coach then went and picked rather pretty much the same group of players, and sure enough we ended up with the same end result. Mystifying, as you said earlier on, for different reasons perhaps.
I suppose there's some honour in picking pretty much the same group of players to defend the trophy that they won 4 years ago,
more than your world champions.
I don't think that I don't think it helped in that situation. It's a classic situation that coaches fall into, isn't it? I just think that Lippi came in at the wrong time, the wrong cycle, I think. He had to come in because he replaced Donadoni. He had to come in not long before the Euro 2008, and so he relied on his old stages to an extent there. And then I don't think that he necessarily had enough headspace and to be able to bring in some new players. So, the good side for Italy is that they will now be able to regenerate themselves free of any sort of obligation to the old guard.
Quite so. And so the tournament sort of breezed on through the first round into the second, and we started to see some of the better teams emerge. We mentioned Argentina. In fact, I think we predicted Argentina to get to the final, and we weren't that far out. They only fell a couple of rounds short. But
how spectacularly they fell, though.
Well, yeah, but they were great value for while they lasted in the competition. Yeah, exactly, Argentina were a real breath of fresh air. Just wanted to go back to one quote from the preview that we did, which we didn't pick up on. I think it went by so quickly we didn't even realise what was said. But in view of Diego Maradona's previous stomach stapling ventures that he's had in the past, there was something you said, Terry, which was that you said, "I think Diego will bust a gut to get in the final," which I think had we known what you said at the final at the time would have been would have generated much more mirth than I think it did. But there we are. But well put nonetheless. We haven't really mentioned Germany that much. Of course, Germany did very, very well and ended up knocking out Argentina from the competition eventually. I think, Terry, you said across the entire tournament, Germany are going to struggle. Moving on. Graham, I think you said if Germany finished top and England finished second, we'll be playing them in the second round. So that was a good little preview for everyone. So you tipped everyone off about that. So, like I said, we got through. And there were teams getting through to the latter stages, into the knockout stages, who perhaps we wouldn't have predicted. People like Uruguay, Ghana, obviously Spain were there. They were always going to be there. But I think you mentioned earlier on, Graham, it was a good selection of teams. Some good games in those knockout stages, weren't there?
Yeah, that was fantastic.
What were the best ones for you?
In the quarterfinals?
In the sort of latter stages.
I think because like the second round was pretty much work a day really, because I think all the group winners got through in the second round. The only group winners that didn't get through were the ones that actually finished ahead of England. So so how we finish as high as 13th in the tournament, I'll never know.
yes.
But when it came to the quarterfinals, things went mad, didn't they? I mean, every one of those games had something in them that you could take with you to say, "Bloody hell, did you see that last night? It was great." I mean, with because what was the first quarterfinal? It was
Holland versus Brazil.
It was Holland Brazil, was it?
That's right. It was the Friday, wasn't it? Yeah. It was the Friday of Socrates, and it was Holland versus Brazil. Most people would have been at work watching that. It had Felipe Melo sending off, didn't it? And just general that Brazil's just a total collapse. I mean, just being carried away by their own reflection, weren't they? They said, "Ha ha, here we go. All we need to do is turn up." All we need to do is turn up to win, and they were half right.
They started off well enough, didn't they? But it seemed like they went in at half time and had the sort of half time team talk that changed them for the worst, almost.
Yeah, I think they'd already passed around the port and cigars, I think. and then obviously in the evening afterwards, when we were at Socrates, we watched Uruguay Ghana.
What a game that was!
Is it actually possible now to run the audio tape? Do you think?
I think so. Yes, we can play in the moment when Uruguay Ghana had the chance to wrap up the game basically in the dying moments of extra time with the penalty. And for those of you that weren't at Socrates, this is what it sounded like. And so there you go. So the whole roof was lifted off at that point because it was just an incredible climax to that game. It was a fantastic. I thought Ghana played so well. I mean, they just. I remember on the night thinking this Ghana really are the equivalent to Cameroon in 1990, as in they were in the quarterfinals, and yet Ghana just seemed to play such a much more slick, easy on the eye. Brand of football. It was just fantastic. The way they were just stroking the ball around, they were brilliant. They're a real credit to African football.
And of course, just like 1990, an undeserving team with one good player in it managed to beat them on the night.
Yeah, and suffered thanks to penalties and so on. But I must admit, I had Ghana down as like the worst of all the African teams, as it is. But I hold my hands up. That was just a tremendous performance. You get through, and then obviously Spain sort of bimbled through. The Dutch disappointed the way they approached the final. Really, to my mind, the fact that they went for aggression in the end.
Well, I don't know so much. I mean, like. I've read a lot of criticism of the Dutch style of play in the press, and I think it's a bit rich because, you know, you see this week in, week out in the Premiership, don't you? When you see a decent team, i.e. Arsenal, go against anyone in the bottom half of the Premiership, you know, it's, oh, they don't like the physical game. So I was waiting for those comments to start coming out about Spain. You say, well, you see, it's all right with your passing, but, you know, they just want to try and walk it in the back of the net, don't they?
Yes, that's rich.
Yeah, so you sort of, well, you know, this is actually like any other Premiership game, isn't it?
Pretty much. Yes, indeed. I noticed we're sort of rapidly running out of time, and we've only really given just a skim over the surface, really. But just to sort of summarise, Terry, what were your sort of high points and low points? Your best goal or best team or whatever? What would you pick out?
I think Tevez's goal in the second round against Mexico was just sticks in the mind for me. Van Bronckhorst's goal in the semi-final is probably up there, quite close to it. But Tevez's goal was just such an element of control about that shot was just phenomenal. The team of the tournament for me, obviously being a Bundesliga blogger for a few years now, has got to be Germany. They just completely surprised me at just how good they were and just how refreshing they were. I think it's great that they lost as well, because, I mean, a team like that, you know, doesn't deserve to win the World Cup. They're too good to win the World Cup. You know, they're too uncompromising in their attacking principles. They weren't rounded enough to be able to win the World Cup, and it was great. And they got seen off in the end.
Didn't we in that first game that we looked at that team sheet and I said to you two, didn't I, about the substitute list, about the fact that there's not a lot of change options on there. It's all very, very attacking, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
They decided it's a very attacking. Yeah, that's the way we're going to play, I'm afraid, because we ain't getting any other options.
I know. I think we misunderstood the selection. Basically, we thought, well, because we knew that they had some injury problems going in there, but I think in truth, what was always the case was that, well, this is actually how we intend to play. The only difference is that we don't have a plan B now. We don't have anybody who we can bring on to really shore things up. The only players we've got now can attack. And then we've got a smattering of defenders to go by. And I thought that they were absolutely, you know, for all kinds of different reasons, I thought it was a triumph for Germany this World Cup.
Yeah, I really do.
Yes, an absolute breath of fresh air.
What about you, then, Chris? What do you think of the World Cup?
I thought it was great. It was I wouldn't say it was a classic. I think we were slightly kind of deprived of some top quality, exciting sort of goals or even decent team performances. And you could argue some of the top players kind of let us down a bit on the day. But that's not to say it was a bad World Cup. As somebody sort of said, you know, the World Cup is the World Cup. You enjoy it, whatever it is. But I still thought it was really great. I'm just sorry I didn't get to see more of it, because I made the fatal mistake of going and getting myself a job at Christmas, which... had I stayed unemployed as I was last year, I'd have seen a whole lot more of it. But there we are. I can't have everything. But quickly from my point of view, in terms of best goals, I've always loved long range kind of screamers. You know, I just grew up sort of seeing old archive stuff on Match of the Day, like Alan Mullery and Terry McDermott just hitting the ball from like miles out, flying in the top corner. So for that reason, I think Van Bronckhorst's goal for Holland against against Uruguay in the semi-finals was just top draw for me, and similarly Shabalala's one in the very first game was similarly accurate. I thought it was brilliant, and Germany's goals were just brilliant because they were great team goals. You know, you couldn't really say an individual really, but the way they put everything together and got their goals was just wonderful. Graham, what would you go for in terms of best goal or best team or even best coach or something like that?
Well, I don't know. For best team, I think we've got to make a shout out for New Zealand, who we all thought that were going to end up like you know, being the whipping boys of the tournament, and ended up being the only team to go through it unbeaten. I think like some special award must be cast for them. I think to for them to take home with them. I think like as far as best coach is concerned, I mean, like obviously really the most interesting coach in the whole tournament was obviously the Maradona, wasn't he? I mean,
El Diego,
which, you know, the coverage showed more of him than his team, which was a bit of a shame because his team played pretty well actually.
Well, I think rightly so. Apparently, all the press conferences involving Diego Maradona were just like hottest ticket around, and nobody could get in there to sort of see him. But he was—I just thought he sort of brought a lovely sort of innocence to that whole role of manager. He just sort of, you know, I mean, someone could say he's sort of acting a little bit sort of even immaturely at times. But yeah. I just thought he was great value.
He's certainly one of the faces of the World Cup. I mean, certainly one of the figures of the big figures, the dominating figures of the last World Cup. Him and Diego Forlán, of course, who I thought it was just so good to see him. I mean, a player that I mean, for those of us that follow European football, we know how good Forlán is, and it was just peaking at the right time of his career, just in time to take his team to the semi-final of the World
His
Cup
goal in the quarter-final as well was a peach as well. So
yeah, I mean, his goal in the third place playoff, which was a cracking game by the way, was also truly spectacular as well. That beautiful volley that he took to I think it was to equalise, and what a player he is, and will be remembered as one of the great World Cup players of all time. Diego Forlán, fantastic. He will be right up there with some of the true greats of world football.
Rightly or wrongly, the moment of the World Cup for me will probably be Luis Suarez as well. I think it just has to be. I know it's probably not the right thing to do, but I mean, like, you know, I think someone posted. I think it was Just Football. It was posted afterwards. He said a quote from Alex Ferguson was, "Football, bloody hell," and it's exactly that. what happens in football, and yes, you know injustices will happen, and you've just got to put up with it. I mean, like, you've got the fact that if you want to love football, you know, like any love, you've got to be able to rip your heart out and laugh in your face.
But you say that, I mean, in terms of Terry, I know you wrote an excellent sort of, or you didn't write an excellent piece, you did an excellent podcast, not so, at the time, just sort of talking about it. But fact of the matter is, Uruguay and indeed Luis Suarez got punished for it at the time. It wasn't like if he'd have handled the ball on the line and the referee hadn't noticed it, then, you know, big outrage and rightly so. But as it is, you know, he got sent off. Ghana got a penalty. So actually the whole thing's kind of redundant in a sense, they just didn't take the chance.
Exactly that, Chris. I think it's so much focus in the World Cup up to that point has been to say that, you know, if we had technology in this game, you know, all the injustice would go away and everything, we'd live in a utopian sort of world. And you see that and you say, well, look, everyone saw what happened there. The referee called it spot on and he did exactly what is in the rules of the game to do. And you still go away with a sour taste in your mouth if that doesn't work out the way you want it to work out.
I mean, and it's just, I defy anyone to not expect a player from their team to do exactly the same thing under those circumstances.
If I was Luis Suarez, I would do exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Graham, absolutely. Have you swallowed the microphone?
No, it's my voice, I'm afraid.
So you're sounding very muffled. I'm not sure if it will come out like that on the thing.
No, I'm sure.
Well, the muffler is anyway.
Don't worry about it.
Never mind. Well, just quick time for one quick question we had from Rich Johnson, who just questioned what we thought about the TV coverage. Do you all share my view that basically it's time to now relegate the likes of Hansen and Lawrence and put them in a little box and lock it up and throw it out to sea in favour of something a bit better? Because it's getting a bit tawdry now, isn't it, all that?
I mean, the whole coverage hasn't changed at all, has it, since the beginning of the Premier League, has it?
Well, they must have been doing it for about 20 years now, like Hansen and Lawrence.
I was glad to see that the final wasn't covered by Motson or Pearce. I mean, I thought that was a refreshing change, but that was the only thing I could pick out that was in any way different to what we were normally being fed. And you know, it did seem very staid on both channels. It's almost like you know, they don't want to they don't want to push anything too far because, you know, it could all go horribly wrong, and then there's so much rides on the World Cup, I suppose, that.
Mm. Yeah, but ITV, what have they got to lose? Sorry.
No, true. No, you're absolutely right. What do they have to lose? Yeah. I mean, you know, they could do a lot better than putting, you know, Tilsley and Beglin on, couldn't they?
I thought I was going to say those two words that strike fear into any man, James Corden.
oh God, yes.
Well, the it was ITV who actually came up with that original kind of panel approach to In Mexico 1970. I mean, they were pioneers, and it was Brian Moore, Jimmy Hill, and Malcolm Allison, Brian Clough, you know, Joe Mercer, I think. And it's the same format that exists now, you know, what, 30 years, 40 years later. Mm. And it really needs a refresh. It needs to be changed. And I mean, ITV are always going to get slaughtered, particularly in the cup final, by the BBC. So why didn't they just, I mean, they got Adrian Charles in. Why didn't they just say, right, you know what, we're going to look at the format here and we're going to do something totally, totally different. And it just hasn't done that. What struck me particularly about the BBC's coverage was just the apparent lack of research.
Oh, no, it was disrespectful. It really was
disrespectful. They're turning up there and laughing about the fact that they knew nothing about the
teams. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, 20 years ago, you could get away with that crap when no one knew any better. But not now. Not now that we've got so much coverage of European football. We've got so many non-domestic games shown live in this country now. There's a huge interest in it, and a huge interest on the internet as well from fans. And to just stay there and just say, "Oh, well, we don't know a lot about these people," well, you know, you've got no excuse not to know a lot about these teams.
Well, the interesting thing about this, Graham, is that I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, you know what? I'm sure in previous World Cups they did. I think what's happened is that the BBC, like virtually every other organisation in the world, has had to put the squeeze on the spending, and I think they cut back on their researchers.
Quite
and
possibly,
obviously,
yeah.
because the level of research, the mocking tone,
I'm sure there are people working in BBC research departments who do a very good job at it, but whether or not they're actually listened to by these sort of pretty much tired, you know, lazy.
Hmm.
Going back to what I don't know whether I said it on this one at all, but I can't remember which game it was, but I think it was Pierce and Lawrence, and Pierce came up with some stat about a team that they were watching of moderate interest, and I was like, well, I know what you've been doing this afternoon. It's like, yes, mate, he's been working. That's what he's paid to do.
He's been researching
the teams and the players that he's been watching. What have you been doing? You've been out on the golf course with Alan Shearer, haven't you? And I just find that intensely irritating, because I don't mind it so much for the ITV, because whatever. ITV are answerable to their advertisers. I mean, like, if they're crap, then I get no ratings and the advertisers kick the shit out of them. But the BBC is licensed fee paying money, and, you know, I'm sorry, but I'm paying your wages and I expect a little bit more, to be perfectly honest with you. I know that sounds a little bit, you know, sort of, you know, Daily Mail. but it's true, you know. I mean, they're licensed fee funded and they're paid by public money, and they've got a responsibility to go out there and actually do some work. Everybody else is expected to work for a bloody living.
Wasn't there one instance where they were having a chat on the BBC on Match of the Day, and Lee Dixon came out with some line about one of the players? I can't even remember which player it was. It might have been a Uruguayan player or something like that. And Alan Hansen sort of joked, "Oh, I know where you got that line from," sort of insinuating that the director or researcher had given him that line, sort of, as if to say that during the programme. And they had a good old laugh about it. And you just think, like, you were really sort of showing yourself up there as just being tired and lazy, frankly, and just like not being...
enjoying their ignorance, basically, weren't they?
Yeah. Well, and just very quickly, just to sort of sum all that up, I mean, you were talking to Terry about the whole thing about the ITV sort of created the whole concept of having a panel. What made it such a success, though, back in those days, in the early 70s or late 60s, whenever it was, is that they used to get people on who had really interesting opinions and quite strong opinions, whereas now all they can do is get, well, Lee Dixon.
Gareth Southgate, yeah.
And it's all kind of wallpaper. It's just sort of, you know.
The natural successor to that format, of course, is Soccer Saturdays. So those are the same kind of guys that they've got on there. Because, I mean, you could wheel those guys out for the World Cup and they'd know no more than Dixon or Shearer or Southgate. But they would deliver it in a much more interesting and entertaining way. And I could deal with that. I could deal with that kind of ignorance as long as it was fun to watch.
As I say, it's only as good as the people that get on there, frankly, isn't it? And they don't seem to have... BBC
got that
don't seem to have... picked up on that little fact, but then again, what do I know? Lads, we've already run out over our allotted 30-minute time, but we hope you won't mind listening to all the stuff that we've just been talking about. It's we've only scratched the surface, as I mentioned before, but it's certainly been a great World Cup and one which will linger for some time, I'm sure, in our memories. You know what's coming next, though, don't you? In about 31 days' time, the Premier League season returns, and in fact, even a little earlier than that, of course, we have the Championship and League One and League Two and everything else. Yes. And, of course, we will be back to cover it. I say, of course, you won't have known that, but we made a solemn pact some time ago and we've decided we're going to do all this all over again. So just wanted to basically take time just to say thank you to everybody who's been listening to our podcast right the way through the Premier League season, and indeed through the World Cup as well. If you've been listening at any stage, if you've been downloading the podcast via iTunes, or if you've sent us a message on Twitter or Facebook, anything like that, thank you very much indeed for your involvement and for showing an interest. We really do appreciate it, and we strongly urge you to do the same again for the Premier League season. We hope to be back, I think, on the 9th of August, if we've got our dates correct, for a preview of the new season, the new domestic season. Lots to look forward to. New managers, new players, new teams, everything. So do join us for that on the 9th of August. But for now, from this World Cup review on The Sound of Football, thank you very much indeed. And it's goodbye from myself, from Terry, and from Graham. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Follow The Sound of Football on Twitter at www.twitter.com/soundoffootball.